I'm a software engineer. I've got a side project and I want to, like, you know, put something live. I've got it local. I want to get it live. Is Azure for me, or should I look somewhere else?
This episode is sponsored by Porkbun, a refreshingly different domain name registrar with over 500 domain extensions available. Porkbun offers everything from .com and .net to .app, .tech, and .dev. Every Porkbun domain comes with lots of freebies like SSL certificates, Whois privacy, URL forwarding, and hosting trials, all backed by 5-year support, 365 days a year. For tech folks, it gets even more exciting. They've even launched a new AI-generated search tool using ChatGPT that is leading the change in how people search for domain names. To celebrate the 5th anniversary of .app, Porkbun is offering a .app or .dev domain name for free to Test and Code listeners. To get your .app or .dev domain name for free, visit porkbun.com/testandcode or click the link in the show notes. Thank you, Porkbun, for sponsoring this episode. Welcome to Test and Code. Well, welcome to the show. It's kind of neat to have you here. So you're Pamela Fox, right?
Yeah, that's right. Yep.
Okay. This is a terrible intro. I'm out of practice. So, but you were recently on Python Bytes. I don't know how... Somebody convinced, did Michael convince you to come on there or something? Or?
He just towed it at me. And
okay.
Like, that's cool. I decided I should, you know, go on more streams just so I change out of my pajamas on a more frequent basis.
So that was episode 323. Tell me who you are and, like, you know, what do you do?
So I am currently at Microsoft on the cloud advocacy team, specifically the Python team. And I've only been here for maybe 6 months or so. Actually, no, 9 months, because I basically joined and then I had my baby the 5 days after. And my baby is now 9 months old. So yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. It was a very quick rush to get set up before the baby came out.
But did you get to take time off then?
I did. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Good. So after I joined, I said hi to everyone on my team. And then 5 days later, I disappeared for 3 months. and then I took some time off later too. Okay. And before that, I was at UC Berkeley teaching Python for a year and a half. And that was nice because I never really had gotten deep into Python. I'd used it for years and years and years and years. But, you know, I used it the way you use something to you know, build tools. I didn't really get into the nitty gritty. But when you have like thousands of students asking questions, you get into the nitty gritty pretty fast. So that was really fun.
Level was that, like introductory, like CS 101 or?
Well, that's a good question because this is at UC Berkeley. So it was CS61A, and that's the first class in the Berkeley CS sequence. But we usually call it a 1.5, and that it's this first class in the sequence, but it's really not designed for people who have never programmed before. So we beg people to do an actual proper intro to programming class before they take CS61A because it is really difficult. And at least when I was there, it was somewhat the weeder course in that your grade in it would actually determine whether you could be a CS major, which, you know, that everything about that sucks. But it was a very interesting course to, you know, if we ignore everything about how academia is horrible.
Yeah. Well, at least it's Python because the weeder course I took was Lisp.
I didn't mention it was also Scheme. If you want to talk about Scheme.
That's what we did. So you did. So they still do that. Okay.
So our course is called the Structure and Interpretation of Computer Programs. So it was originally taught in Scheme and then ported to mostly be in Python. And then at the end of the semester, we would do Scheme and we would write a compiler for Scheme in Python.
Well, that actually might be fun.
I actually like that. I think it's really interesting to write compilers, because you get to really understand understand it more. Where you do mu scope. Scheme has something called mu scope, which is a different scope than we have in Python. And so getting to actually implement that, I think that's really interesting.
Okay. So UC Berkeley, and then where'd you go there then after that?
Oh yeah. So before that, I've had, that was my most recent, but don't know what order to go in, but my first job was at Google, where I was on the Maps API, and that's where I did a lot of JavaScript, and then did some Python at the end when App Engine came out, and wrote a bunch of App Engines app in Python. And then after Google, I was at Coursera, where I was one of the first front-end engineers, although of course I was really full stack, and our stack was Django.
Okay.
At the time, until we changed it all. And then I went to Khan Academy, where I wrote most of the computer programming courses that are still on the site, and also was a full stack engineer. And there the stack was Flask on Python.
Okay. Nice. The stack being the stack that you were writing,
for Khan Academy, it was the stack that it was running on. The courses that we taught that are up there now still are JavaScript, HTML, and SQL. So Khan Academy never actually taught Python, but it was running on Flask. They did recently did a whole big project to port it over to Go. So I have briefly been a Go engineer as well.
Okay. All right. So that's your career. How did you decide to get into this in the first place?
Oh,
you remember?
Well. Yes. Well, my dad is a computer scientist and my mom is a scientific programmer. So
They're both
pretty into computers. They met at Caltech. So my dad was working on physics at Caltech and early in the supercomputers movement. So he built a supercomputer called the Caltech Cosmic Cube, which is a really, really cool name. And he was working with so he was actually the advisor of Stephen Wolfram, and he was working with Feynman. They were, I think, both co-advisors of the physics department or something. So yeah, so he was way into computing, because that was how they could do physics calculations more quickly, especially parallel computing. And so he still does that today. He does a lot of distributed computing research. Nice. And then my mom, she was at Caltech and then went on to work at JPL, and she would write programs for software, for satellites to go up in the air. And she did a lot of analysis of spectrums, stuff. Nice. I don't actually understand, because I'm not a scientist.
Well, that just sounds amazing. I'm just coming from it from a perspective of, like, everybody at my Thanksgiving says, so what do you do?
Yeah, whereas the only conversations I ever have with my dad are about cloud computing. He loves talking about cloud computing.
Interesting. Well, I'm going to actually ask you about that also. So the role, this is perfect. So you're the Python, one of the Python dev advocates for Microsoft. Mm-hmm. Is everybody, all the people I know, I guess you don't know who I know, but Anthony and others, are they focused on Azure or Python, or is it the same thing?
Yeah. So our team is Anthony Shaw and Jay Miller, Sarah Kaiser, and me. So we are the Python cloud advocacy team. So if those are the people, we are all focused on Python with Azure. Although Sarah, the thing is, like, we all dabble into everything. So we're also hoping that Python works well in Viz Code, and we do a lot of looking into that and code spaces and dev containers. Sarah in particular does a lot around the Jupyter experience, because Sarah comes from a scientific computing background. So that's more, she's like the expert there. But yeah, generally we're tasked on helping Python developers be successful with Azure services.
Okay. Well, so I'm going to kind of guess I jump into the topic. When I search for Azure, I get azure.microsoft.com shows up, and then even if I sign up or something, or look at, it's a little, or at least I haven't looked lately, but it, last time I tried to look, it was a little intimidating. Mm-hmm. so is, and it actually, I wasn't sure if I really should be there. Like, maybe I don't belong here. It feels like it might be perfect for a business, but how about, and the topic I kind of want to bring up is, I'm a software engineer. I've got a side project and I want to, like, you know, put something live. I've got it local. I want to get it live. Is Azure for me, or is, should I look somewhere else?
Yeah, that's a great question. So I, you know, when I was on maternity leave, I did get really bored because babies do a lot of sleeping in the first 3 months, actually, primarily sleeping on me. So, so I did start taking my old App Engine apps and porting them to Azure. And, I couldn't ask anyone on my team how to do it because in theory, I wasn't working. So, you know, I had to do some searching myself and figure it out. So what I started with, was, App Service, and that I think is the most approachable, way to get started and to deploy apps. And it's the most, akin to App Engine. So if you're coming from somewhere else. So I basically went through these, I found these App Service tutorials and went through the tutorials and then started porting my apps over. So yeah, I think App Service is designed to be quite easy to get started, and it has code built in that understands about Flask apps and Django apps. So it actually tries to do the right thing for Flask apps and Django apps, but you can also override that code. If you have your own configuration, like your own G-Unicorn configuration or something like that, then you can override that code. But the build system, it's called Oryx. It does actually have all this code to detect Flask, detect Django, and set them up appropriately. So I think that is a approachable for, you know, just a non-enterprise software developer. And the pricing for that is pretty good. Where it does get tricky is when you're starting up, when you're adding a database, because databases are more expensive than the hosting platforms.
If I've got Django, I've got a database, right?
Right. So that's the thing, right? If you're doing Django, you most likely have a database. And if you were doing just like a single server somewhere, you know, like a server that you rent to the cloud, then you could use, you know, SQLite, and yes, Simon Wilson, you know, big fan of SQLite. And locally, of course, you could use SQLite, but you can't use SQLite at least in the Azure cloud because of the file system, how it's set up in the cloud, because of it being NFS, I think. Just the way the file system is set up, it's just not reliable to use SQLite, so it's not recommended. So that means you need a proper database. So Azure does have databases. The one that I use the most often is the Postgres Flexible Server, but it does cost a minimum of about $12 a month, depending on what region you're in. So that to me could be a decision factor for someone. Are you willing to spend $12 a month on your database? It depends on like what level of, you know, hobbyists that we're talking about here, right?
Right. Okay.
If you're hoping to spend $0 on the database, you know, if you're okay with 12, then it is a nice option.
Okay. So like, what's the rest of it? So if I'm paying $12 for the database, what's the rest of it? And okay, I'm going to be like, I've told you this, but I want to be transparent with everybody else listening. I have a side project. It's one of the reasons why I've been kind of absent since like last August or something like that, is I've kicking around the side project idea. So I want to get it off the ground. It's still just sort of in the idea phase. I've been doing a lot of research, but I do want to get it to the point where it can make a little money. And for me, I think $12 a month, that's fine.
Yeah.
But what is the rest of it? I mean, that's the database, but am I paying for the application also then?
Good question. So, there's this pricing calculator that I've started using recently because you can actually put in all the services and do the calculations for it. But you can also just look at the individual pricing pages. the thing is that the pricing does vary on region, and I think maybe where you yourself, where you live, perhaps too. But if we look at the app service pricing, by currency. Okay, so like central US, USD. So the thing is that there's different SKUs, different configurations, depending on how much, you know, how much traffic you need, right? So there is on app service, there is a free usage tier with, like, you know, starting off with your free account. Then you could go to a shared environment, and they call that for just dev and test. And that would be 0.013 per hour. Then if you go to basic, they still claim that's for dev and test, but I run all of mine on basic. I should double check that, but I think all of mine are running on basic. There you get 10 gigabytes of disk space, up to 3 instances, and then that's 0.075 per hour. So how many hours are in a month? 730. Okay, so 730 times 0.075. So that one says that's $54, but I haven't paid $54 for any of mine. Okay. So I must be running, maybe I'm even running on free or shared right now. So, you know, I think it does depend on what, you know, what's the traffic you expect. Can you do caching, right? So I put all of my things behind, usually behind a CDN, right? It depends on what you're doing and whether you can do any form of caching. But the CDNs are, you know, generally cheaper because all they're doing, you know, they're just a cache. They don't have to do a lot of computing. And so that lowers my prices quite a bit. So let me just see which app service plan I'm using on my personal account. I do try to do things on my personal account just so I can feel the pain of budgeting myself. Okay. So I am using B1, basic one. Okay. But that has not really cost me very much. For me, the thing that has cost has been the Postgres server.
Okay. Well, the per hour thing is confusing to me. Is it like, is that just the hours in the month, or is it the hours that it's actually getting used? Does it?
Yeah, that's a good question, because the Postgres server, you can actually stop it. So I actually, with one of my apps, it's an app that allows people to type in things and then see it translated into 20 languages. It's called Translation Telephone, and people were typing some horrible things. So I shut it down recently while I work on a better scheme to prevent people from being horrible on the internet. But I discovered that I could actually also just stop my Postgres server, and I won't be charged for it.
Well, yeah, but I mean, like, let's say I've got, I think I'm going to have users, but nobody's using it today, or
right.
For 12 hours or something like that. Do you pay for that also? Or?
Cause this is a good question.
Maybe this shouldn't be the focus, but it's not free, but it's not terrible if you're actually going to make some money.
Yeah, I think that's probably a good description. And these are good questions. I'm still trying to wrap my head around the pricing. And I think that's one of the hard things about cloud computing is trying to understand how the pricing actually works. And it depends on the service. Like with some services, it is, you know, the amount of time the service is running. Some of them is whether it's actually servicing requests. Some of them also has to do with CPU or memory. So I need to look into that more.
Okay. Well, so that's the app app service. Is there? I mean, is that'd be a good place to start then? Do you think?
Yeah. So in terms of options on Azure for Python developers, the things to usually consider are app service, functions, container apps, or Kubernetes service. So app service is our, you know, the thing you'd call a platform as a service, which does the most for you. And is the thing that's recommended if you're doing a standard, you know, website where you've got users coming to the website, doing stuff on the website, you're updating a database. Functions could work well, serverless. If you, have something that, maybe it's a chatbot hitting up a function, then you might use a function. And then container apps or Kubernetes. Container apps is basically a wrapper for Kubernetes. So we recommend container apps if you're doing a microservice type architecture, but you don't want to deal with Kubernetes. And then, of course, Kubernetes if you want to deal with Kubernetes. So if you're doing a Django app, most likely you're looking at app service.
Okay. So you mentioned Django and Flask. Yes, those are very common. But an up-and-coming thing is Fast API. Can I do Fast API on app service?
Yeah, you can. Yeah. So I almost deployed one this morning on app service. So right now, most of my Fast API demos, they do run on functions. But I was talking with Anthony the other day, and he actually thinks that they might actually work a bit better on app service. Just because he thinks there might be some initial startup time for Fast API. So we actually want to do a little comparison with putting a Fast API app on app service versus a function to see the difference. But yeah, you could definitely put it on app service. I'll probably put one on app service later today just for fun.
Let me know what you find out.
Well. Yeah. Well, what I should do is put the same one. It's actually really easy to switch between the two. Because they actually both run on top of similar infrastructure. So when you create them for both of them, you create an app service plan as well. So they are actually both running on fairly similar Azure infrastructure.
Okay. And one of the things you're looking at right now is your GitHub profile. Yeah. It's github.com/PamelaFox. There's like a ton of little demo things that you've done, and this is pretty cool. You got Flask, you've got Fast API, whole bunch of stuff, Django even, there's a column there that's AZD. What is that?
So AZD is this CLI, the Azure Developer CLI, and it is actually going to get renamed fairly soon from what I've heard. And I don't know what the new name is, but it's in preview right now. And I'm a huge fan. I'm like the fangirl on the team. So that's why you see me making everything AZD compatible. But the point of it is actually to use infrastructure as code in order to define the resources for your app so that you can then provision those resources and reliably deploy it. So it's basically, if you know Terraform, it actually supports Terraform, right? So Terraform is how you can declare infrastructure as code. Azure also has its own language called Bicep. So I happen to write Bicep, but I should conceivably learn Terraform as well. But the point is to declare, declaratively describe the resources that that you need on, on the cloud, so that they can be easy to create.
Well, bro, what do you mean? So the services, like you have a services column that is CDN, a service that you can configure also then?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So if we look at, so it's all the resources that you would need for your app. If you were just doing a Flask app on app service and you deployed that, you would only see two things in your portal. You'd see an app service plan and you'd see app service. Those are two resources that you need for an app service app. But then you start to add a database, right? So then you're going to see a database and maybe you're going to have some logging. So then you actually see this log analytics workspace. So they're all these Azure resources that you mix and max together. And that's something I actually found really different when I came from old school App Engine to Azure. Because with the old school App Engine, before their recent stuff, everything was bundled up. So you would use the App Engine database, you would use the App Engine Memcache. It was all bundled and you would just deploy it all in one go. I think these days App Engine is more of a mix and match like Azure, but that was something that was a little tricky for me to understand at first. Like, oh wait, I have to decide what resources I want, and then I have to put them together.
Okay.
So that can be a little tricky, right? Because figuring out what you need. Because if you add a database on, then you've got a database. But then if you want to like make that database secure, like, of course, you should use a good, you know, password and IP protection, all that. But you could also add a virtual network. So, you know, in my Bicep, I can declare a virtual network. I can declare a private DNS zone. So there's all these things, a CDN. Hmm. These are, you know, all things that resources that you may want to bundle with your app, you know, and by having it all declared in infrastructure as code, then you can have repeatable deploys.
Okay, so you're showing me the like a file that's for one of your apps that's the main.bicep. Mm-hmm. Is this the easy version? Because this you said there was a CLI that made it easy. This doesn't look that easy, actually.
Well, it's now that I've written it, all you have to do is type AZD up and it'll go up. So the thing that's hard is writing the infrastructure as code. And yeah, we were actually debating this yesterday. Like, do we expect software developers, you know, like you and me, to be writing Bicep or writing Terraform? And that's a good question. I actually don't know. I don't know how many software developers are writing those. I find it really empowering now, because once I have these Bicep files written, I can, you know, go to any of these apps and just type AZD up, and then I've got it all deployed, even if it's, you know, 10 different resources interacting inside a virtual net, right?
Well, that's pretty cool. Yeah. I'm glad that you have these examples up, because if I try this, I might want to use some of your examples.
Yeah. So like, here's an example here, which is, this is actually the one I would point you to, because this is a Postgres server that does not have a virtual net, because you may not, you know, it's up to you whether you think it's necessary to have virtual net level security, because that also is going to increase your cost. The other thing you could do is, you know, use the most recent Postgres. So like 14, and then, you know, use firewalls to only allow Azure IPs or only allow your own IP. And that might be secure enough for you. That's your decision to make. But this particular Bicep declares a Postgres server with that firewall rule, declares an app service app, and then an app service plan and an analytics workspace, and that's it. So it's 100 lines of code. It's already written. So you could just take this and, you know, make some customizations if you want to change the Python version, if you want to change the environment variables, if you want to change the startup script.
Okay, but change those. Okay, but this would like do things that connect my, make it so that my app can see my database and things like that.
So, yeah.
Neat. Mm-hmm. And then there's a AZD up. Something that can, or, you know, the script formerly known as AZD.
Yeah. So if you just install the Azure Developer CLI and then you just use the command AZD up, what it does is it looks at your infrastructure files. It figures out what resources you want to provision and does the provisioning. And it only creates things if they're not there already, right? And it updates things if they need updating. And then it will bundle all your code up together, whatever code you tell it to deploy. And it will actually, you know, upload that to the Azure servers so that your app is ready.
Neat. So my code's on my computer. Now it's in the cloud. No, it's not in the cloud yet. Or the services are.
When you do AZ up, it's doing provisioning and deploy.
Okay. Now, do I do that again when I make changes, like to my app?
Or? Yeah, you can do AZD up. You can also do AZD deploy. If you know that you haven't changed the infra at all, you could just do AZD deploy. And then it's not going to even, you know, look. I just do AZD up because I'm lazy. And I know that it's just going to skip over the resource creation if it's the same. But you can also just do AZD deploy. And that will just do the deployment stage.
Okay. And if I've got like database migrations, that's a completely different ball of wax, right?
Yeah, that's a good question. I was actually talking about database migrations yesterday with Anthony. So right now we do that in the startup script, so that each time you deploy, so here this is a Flask app, right? In the startup script, I run FlaskDB upgrade. But I think realistically, if I was doing this in a production app, I would probably, you know, deploy the new schema, right? So you always deploy the schema first. Not, you know, the changes to views, right? So deploy the new schema, and then go, you know, go to the portal page on Azure, go to the SSH, so you can SSH into your app. And then I would probably just run it manually from SSH. That's, okay. I think, what I would do. But then we were actually debating what the, like, you know, what the strategies are for upgrading. So I'm curious what other people do there.
Okay. And the people listening aren't going to be able to see the stuff we're looking at, but the individual pieces don't look too terrible. So I'm glad that there's some examples to look at. And I'm sure that there are other places that people can find some examples, but we'll link to your Flask DB quiz example for people to look at. So that's pretty cool. So I got my idea. Now it's up. And after I do AZD up, I assume at some point Microsoft will send me an invoice, or I've already set up my credit card probably with them and everything. So
yeah,
it'll be there. So what do we need to worry about? And you mentioned security a little bit. Since I'm going to assume that I don't know about security. I mean, I know that it's the word and I should care about it. But for, like, let's say I'm not, I just kind of want it to stay alive. What's the minimal security that I should care about right away? Do you have an opinion?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, if you're doing a Django app, you should follow the Django best practices. So you want to like configure the CSRF and the allowed hosts. So I always do that in the configuration, right? So in the configuration, I only allow the host name that's deployed. And you also want to generate a secret key if you're doing any sort of user login. And actually, this particular repo doesn't follow that best practice, but you should. So on production, you know, setting up the allowed host, setting up the secret key, and generating those correctly. So following Django best practices, right? That's what you should be doing when you have a Django app anywhere. And then the big thing is the database, right? So can somebody hack into your database? How secure is it? So I typically always have SSL mode required, which is good. And then using the most recent version of Postgres 14, that's a good thing to do because it has some security improvements. And then using a properly random password, so like 30 character randomly generated, not password with funny symbols. And then setting up in a firewall, so that's, you can either set up a firewall or a VNet, but if you're, you know, trying to be minimal about it and about costs, then, setting up a firewall so that, you can have it so it only allows Azure IPs. So that's a pretty good level of security. You can watch, Anthony has a great talk I watched from CitusCon last year about hacking into Postgres servers using a little hacking tool he wrote. So you could run that hacking tool and see if it can get in. Yeah, it tries to get, guess a lot of passwords. That's pretty good. And you could also run these tools in the portal that will give you recommendations on security.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah. Sometimes I follow them and sometimes I always follow them.
So the one of the things you brought up was secrets. Is that I assume there's like a secret service that I can use also to store things like passwords and things like that?
Yeah, there is. It's called Azure Key Vault. And so I do use that in most of my recent stuff that I do. I do use that because it's pretty cost effective to put stuff into Key Vault. And there's built-in support for app service to grab things out of Key Vault. So it works really well to store secrets into Key Vault.
Okay. And then do you like bring it into an environmental variable or something? Or how does that...
Yeah, it's built in that app service has a way of, let me see if I can pull it up, but app service has a way where in your environment variables, you can either type in the value or you can tell it to reference a secret. Okay. It's called a secret ref. I have to find
You had like an Azure API key or something like that. That's what, I mean, I think a lot of people that are, I had to figure this out not too long ago when setting up deploys from GitHub to PyPI. for instance, because you get your secrets from PyPI and you stick it in a place in GitHub and then they know about each other.
Yeah. So I would recommend Key Vault. Each of the different Azure services have slightly different ways of working with Key Vault, but it's generally, there's generally a good way of storing stuff in Key Vault because then you can do secret rotation and that sort of stuff. So at the bare minimum, you know, put it in environment variable, but even nicer is to put it in Key Vault because then it's harder to compromise, right? You have to go through a fair amount of effort to actually see the value, right? With environment variable, you know, it's they make it easy to see the values of environment variables because that's something you might want to look at. But with a secret, you know, you have to click and say like, yeah, I really want to see it. So it's generally better to store stuff there.
Now, one of the things that I was impressed by is, well, I mean, you're kind of in it, you're living it. And you can do things really fast. So how fast when you're if you had to like come up with a new demo for something, aside from the figuring out how to do it in the first place, how long does it take you to get it live from not live?
It depends if it's an infrastructure I've done before. So if it's infrastructure I've done before, then it's quite easy, right? So this weekend, I wanted to make another example of container apps with CDN. So I made this API using the API Flask framework that outputs charts using matplotlib. And that was actually, you know, so it basically just took me the weekend. And by the weekend, I mean just my baby's nap times on the weekend, right? Because that's what I'm working on stuff. So there, like the infrastructure I didn't have to really change the infrastructure at all. It was already there. So I was just learning API Flask and schema thesis library for testing. So if it's an existing infrastructure, then it's, you know, it's easy. I'm just copying over files. If it's a new infrastructure, you know, it depends if there's something that's not straightforward about it or that's not supported by Bicep or the Azure Developer CLI. And there are a few things like that. That might be a little more complicated, or like I, you know, if it depends how many services you're involving. So I'm also working on, if you know Django Cookie Cutter, have you seen that?
I have not particularly, but I know Cookie Cutter and Django.
So there is a Django Cookie Cutter repo, and it's quite popular. And I am working on adding Azure support to that to see. I don't know if they're going to accept my change, but you know, I wanted to see if it was possible. And so that's been the most involved template I've made because that involves, you know, it involves the database, but it also involves storage for media uploads. It involves Redis for both the Django cache, you know, decorators, but also for Celery because it has Celery built in. So that's definitely the most involved template that I've made, and I want it to be really nice. So I'm not done with that yet. Because you know, I really want to refine that and make sure I'm using all the services well. So sometimes things might take time if I'm trying to use a lot of services or just really shore it up.
And now this might be a dumb question, but in the end, I've got something live. It's got some random IP address or something, I assume. Mm-hmm. How do I connect to my thing, my cool domain name that I registered to the live thing?
Yeah, good question. So I run PamelaFox.org off of Azure as well as TranslationTelephone.com. So they're both running off of Azure. So Azure has custom domains, and sometimes I define that in Bicep, but it's actually easier to do that one manually. So let me see how I set that up. Right. So, I have my way over engineered personal website with a Azure container app plus a CDN in front. So I am going to rewrite this to be a static web app. But so we set that up and then you connect it to a custom domain. So for CDN, a CDN just has a thing on the left hand side, which is just says custom domains, right? Okay. So each of them, where it makes sense to have a custom domain, there's a way to do it. So it depends what you're connecting to it. So if you're connecting to the app service directly, let me get my app service one up. How did I do that? Custom domains. Yeah. So they both, I just go to custom domains on both of them. Okay. And set it up. I think it did take the DNS caching took a long time on PamelaFox.org for some reason that might have to do with my particular DNS registrar. If you're doing a whole new domain from scratch, then, you know, that should be fine. But DNS caching can be pretty annoying.
Yeah. I mean, like, you know, be patient. I've never had it take too long lately. I mean, I've had things, I remember back in the day having to wait till the next day or something like that for things to show up.
Yeah, I feel like for some reason PamelaFox.org took a long, it felt like it took a long time. I don't know. Okay. I don't know. It may be dependent on the browser too. Maybe on, you know, we use a Pi-hole. There's a lot of things that could be affecting it.
But I'm an impatient person now, so I'll like hook everything up and then go check it like minutes later and go, it's not up yet. What's going on?
Well, maybe it tends to work faster also if it's a brand new domain, right? Whereas I was trying to repoint it from Google to Azure.
Okay. Yeah, maybe. But, well, neat. Now, am I overthinking this? Is this kind of the stuff that people should be thinking about when they want to go live? Is there stuff that I haven't thought about?
I mean, so one thing I would do, you know, because you talked about security and that's something you should look into, but also looking into budget, right? So I would use the pricing calculator. I would also set up a budget. And that's something I've done on my personal account because, you know, I want to try stuff out, but I don't want to be spending a lot of money on my personal account. Because this is my job. I'm supposed to get paid for it, not pay for it. So in Azure, somewhere in Azure, you can set up a budget. So I have a budget of just $16 a month. So if I ever go over $16 a month, which is like a fairly low bar, then I do get a notification. And that's a good reminder for me to go in and check to see what I'm, you know, what I'm spending, you know, spending money on. So I can look at the, you know, the charts and get a feel for the cost. So you can do that pricing calculator ahead of time to try and preemptively not spend too much. But then you should definitely be checking in on that budget because this is real money and be checking to see, you know, how much is it that you are actually spending.
Okay. Interesting. I mean, like, I got like my database is taking $12 a month already, right? So
yeah.
Okay. Well, that's pretty cool. And I know that you're able to spin things up in a weekend, probably an average human the first time. What am I looking at? Probably, you know, it's hard to tell, but maybe a week of like a couple hours a night working on this, I can maybe get a site live, or is it going to take way less than?
I mean, our hope is it takes less than that, but it's a great question, right? How much friction is there? I did a test in October where I tried to get a container app going on Amazon, Azure, and Google. And I actually recorded myself the whole time so that I could share the experiences because we wanted to see what the experience was like across them and, like, you know, where the frictions are everywhere. Yeah. Roughly in the end, like, each of them only took me a couple hours to get through their, you know, their respective tutorials. But those were like spread over a couple of days. Cause, you know, sometimes you like run into a wall, right?
Yeah.
And you're like, oh, this doesn't make sense. And then you just have to walk away and then you come back the next day and it's all okay.
Yeah.
Suddenly, right. It makes sense.
So, oh, I didn't see that button there.
Yeah. Right. So there's like how much time it took you of actually doing stuff and then whether, you know, there's something popped up. I mean, one thing you could do, I would probably recommend just doing this, there's this article on deploy Python Postgres UL app to Azure. There we go. Deploy a Django or Flask web app with PostgreSQL and Azure. So I would recommend going through that tutorial first because in theory, this only takes like 30 minutes.
Okay.
And I actually did just update the article today. I don't know if it went live yet. I would recommend going through this tutorial first because it's going to give you a feel for, parts of the portal and stuff like that. It's a nice like gentler introduction before, you know, trying to start with your own app. Your own app has like complexities and edge cases, right? So you don't want to deal with the edge cases first.
Do a toy example first.
Yeah, that's what I would generally recommend with maybe anything is to, you know, to wade into it first with something that is supposed to work.
Oh, that's a good idea.
And then have a go and I'm happy to point you at, you know, infrastructure files if that's the route you decide to go.
Okay. Now we kind of brushed by container, but there are quite a few people that are now used to working with containers a lot. So they're even developing their own stuff as a little container on their own machine. And then what does that look like in this situation? Does that mean that my Postgres and my Flask and everything is together in one container, or do I have like multiple containers with Flask and or the database in one? And
yeah, that's a good question. So with App Service, by default, it's just going to get a bundle of your code and it's going to take care of setting up containers in the cloud. Right. There is an option for App Service called bring your own container. Well, at least that's what we call it. I don't know if that's the official name for it. But there is an option where if you do have a Docker image, you can point at that Docker image and then it won't try to do any fancy build. It's just going to use your image and throw it on the, you know, make container from it. So that's another option. So it, you know, if that's something you're into, I don't find it so necessary to do that because it's already a fairly repeatable. I found it to be fairly repeatable deploy experience. But if you did want to have a little more control over, you know, because I was saying like this build process tries to do the right thing. If you wanted more control over that, then you could just say like, well, here's my image. It does the right thing, right?
Yeah.
But you would still get all the advantages of the App Service scaling, right? And all the, you know, all the ways it works that is designed to be good for a user-facing website. So that's definitely something you do with containers. The other thing you could do is your container apps. So you were asking like, oh, are you putting everything in one? So if you were doing like an app on Azure Container Apps that had a Postgres database, I use Docker Compose locally for developing that. But then when I deploy it onto Azure Container Apps, I'm just deploying the Docker file for the Python app. And then I'm having that Docker app communicate with the managed Postgres service from Azure. Okay. Because then I'm getting all the benefits of the fact that the Postgres team has put in a lot of, you know, expertise into running, you know, this, you know, highly redundant available Postgres in the cloud. And so I don't have to manage that myself, and figure out what that's like. I think you could also, if you wanted to, you could alternatively, deploy a Postgres image on container apps and communicate with that. I haven't done that myself. But it seems like a possibility. It's a good question as to,
I don't know if it's a good question or not. It was just, do these things stay together? Okay.
Yeah. So I tend to use the managed services. No, I know there's people definitely who, cause I'm going to give a talk at the Postgres conference, CitusCon, and they asked me to specify whether I was going to talk about the Postgres managed service or about running Postgres on Azure VMs. And I told them I've never done the latter. So I'm talking about managed service. So I've used the managed service for Postgres. I've used it for, Redis, because there's Azure Redis. So I tend to use the managed services, but for all of those, in theory, you could also be deploying the Postgres image, deploying the Redis image, you know, on container apps or Kubernetes, or even VMs and using them that way. So I think it depends on how much sysops you want to do.
I don't want to do any, but
right, exactly. That's why I use that's why I use managed.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, when you brought up Terraform, I'm like, I know that that's a word.
okay, good to know. But,
I mean,
I swear it's like really cool. So I'm also giving a talk at Python WebConf where I'm going to be talking about about AZD, but really just about how much I love infrastructure as code. And I you're right. I also did not, I knew Terraform was a word. And I remember interviewing someone when I was like CTO of this chatbot. And they were talking about Terraform. And I'm thinking to myself, like, I really should learn Terraform. I really should learn Terraform. And I never did. But now I love it because it's just repeatable deploys. I love repeatable deploys.
Yeah. Yeah, that's cool. Okay. And a lot of what we're talking about really is this gap between, so I go and somebody has like a tutorial on how to do an application in Django or how to do an application with Flask or Fast API or something. And I go run that and I go, oh, cool. It's kind of like what I want to do. So then I go and modify it for the thing I want to do. And it's running on my local machine. Now go from here to live is this huge, feels like a huge hurdle. So this doesn't feel too terrible now. So thank you. It still feels a little scary. But not too bad. Cool. Well, thanks a ton. Now I'm going to hopefully include a bunch of these links if I remember them, in the show notes and, hopefully get this out soon. So thanks so much for your time today.
Sure. Yeah, I'll send over those links. And if people have questions, you can just toot at me.
Toot at you. We'll leave a Mastodon link too for you then as well. Cool. Thanks.